People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos is brought to you by FoundItemClothing.com. Screen-accurate representations of shirts from your favorite cult films. Check them out. Thank you. Today on People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos, we will be talking about Mother Hydra and weirder shadows over Innsmouth. So stay tuned. Not that you tuned into anything, and I don't know, listen to what I have to say. Or don't. Otherwise, thank you for listening to People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. I'm your host, D.B. Spitzer. All right, let's get to it. I think their predominant color was a grayish green, though they had white bellies. They were mostly shiny and slippery, but the ridges on their backs were scaly. Their forms were vaguely suggested by the anthropoid, while their heads were the heads of fish, with prodigious bulging eyes that never closed. At the sides of their necks were palpating gills, and their long paws were webbed. They hopped irregularly, sometimes on two legs or sometimes on four. I was somehow glad that they had no more than four limbs. Their croaking, bane voices, clearly used for articulate speech, held all the dark shades of expressions which their staring faces lacked. They were the blasphemous fish frogs of the nameless design, living and horrible. That is H.P. Lovecraft describing the fish people in The Shadows Over Innsmouth. One thing that we've talked about in the past has been Deep Ones. Another thing that we've talked about in the past has been Dagon. We have not talked about Mother Hydra, who, oddly enough, is a lot like Dagon, just a large, ancient, what do you want to say, Deep One. What do they call themselves? I don't think they call themselves Deep Ones. They don't consider themselves terribly deep, I'm sure. I'm sure they think everything else is way high up. Then they would consider themselves Deep Ones. I don't know. Maybe they do. Mother Hydra lives in Yha-Nhyli. I think that's how you pronounce it. Yha-Nhyli. Yha-Nhyli. Anyway, Cyclopean and many-columned Yha-Nhyli is the only Deep One city named by Lovecraft. It is described as a great undersea metropolis below Devil's Reef, just off the coast of Massachusetts, near the town of Innsmouth. Its exact age is not known, but one resident is said to have lived there for more than 8,000 years ago. Or for that long, 80,000 years. In Lovecraft's story, the U.S. government torpedoed Devil's Reef, and Yha-Nhyli was presumed destroyed, although the ending of the story implies it survived. The name itself may have been inspired by the Lord Dunsany character, Yholmith Lahare, the god of the little dreams and fancies who sendeth the dreams out of Pangaea to please the people of Earth. Other authors have used the Deep Ones and their cities and Dagon and Hydra in their stories. But yeah, from all over the place and all over the world. Hydra gets her name from the Linnaean Hydra, which is awfully known simply as the Hydra, a serpentine water monster in Greek and Roman mythology. Its lair was the Lake of Lernia in the Argolid, which is also the site of the myth of the Danaids. Lernia was reputed to be the entrance to the underworld, and archaeology has established it as a sacred site older than the Mycerian Argos. In the conical Hydra myth, the monster is killed by Hercules using a sword and fire, the second of his 12 labors. According to Hesiod, the Hydra was the offspring of Typhon and Acadia. It possessed many heads, the exact number of which varies from source to source. Later versions of the Hydra story add a regeneration feature to the monster for every head chopped off. The Hydra would grow one or multiple heads. The oldest examples of the Hydra narrative, while the oldest images of the monster found on a pair of bronze fibula dating to 700 BCE. In both these sources, the main motifs of the Hydra myth are readily present: a multi-headed serpent that is slain by Hercules and Lolius. While the fibulae portray a six-headed Hydra, its number of heads was first fixed in writings by Acleus, 600 BCE, who gave it 9 heads. Simondius, writing a century later, increased the number to 50, while Euripides, Virgil, and others did not bother to give an exact number. Hercules was the Heraclitus, the paradoxographer, rationalized the myth by suggesting that the Hydra would have been a single-headed snake accompanied by its offspring. Much like that kind of theory, Mother Hydra is surrounded by her deep ones, thousands and thousands of deep ones. And here's the thing about the deep ones, and Hydra and Dagon, they're just biding their time. They're waiting for the stars to become right when Cthulhu awakens. Because Cthulhu's part of this triad of Cthulhu, Dagon, Hydra. It's a religion. The esoteric order of Dagon. Ever hear of it? Anyway, when the stars come right, millions upon millions, billions of fish people will come out and drag everyone down into the ocean and make more hybrids. Those who survive, at least. Who knows? Maybe some will just be used for breeding, some will be used for food. It's really hard to say. Anyway, madness will ensue.
This has been DB Spitzer for PGTTCM in Smith, Massachusetts.
People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos, hosted by DB Spitzer.
Hey, everyone. Thank you for listening to my podcast about the Cthulhu mythos, where I also talk about books, and I talk about authors, stories, monsters, whatever. Do you have a original horror story relating to the Cthulhu mythos that you would like to have read? Have you a recording of it that you would like me to play? Do you have a book, short story, magazine, album, just a project in general relating to the Cthulhu mythos that you would like to share or have me share with my listeners? Go to pgttcm/contact, fill out the form, let me know, or hit me up on the Facebook and also the Twitter, and you can just find any of those by searching for pgttcm.com. It helps the show, and it'll help you get the word out. All right. Back to the show. And just a simple reminder that the People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos is also part of the Dark Myths Collective, a bunch of cool podcasts about dark and spooky things, the paranormal, political intrigue, history, and all kinds of other stuff. Go to darkmyths.org and check them out. Blurry Photos is there too, and they're pretty cool. All right. Back to the show for real this time. So, I get books. I buy books. I find books. And I love this book that I personally just love. I just love it. It is a really good book by the fine folks at Fennegan and Bremer. And you guys, if I'm saying the name of your company wrong, just let me know. It is a collection of short stories edited by Stephen Jones. And if you don't know who Stephen Jones is an English editor of horror anthologies and author of several book-length studies of horror and fantasy films, as well as an account of Lovecraft's early British publications. Jones and Kim Newman have edited several books together, including Horror's 100 Best Books, the 1988 volume in Xanadu's 100 Best series, and Horror and 100 Other Best Books, a 205 sequel from Carroll and Graff. Each comprise about 100 essays by 100 horror writers and about 100 books, and each was recognized by the Horror Writers of America with its annual Bram Stoker Award for Best Nonfiction. So yeah, he knows what he's doing. So besides Stephen Jones knowing what he's doing, it's a really good collection of a lot of really good short stories that I know you're going to like. If you like Shadows over Innsmouth, you're going to like this. If you like to hear stories about these fish fuckers, you're going to like this. Let's see. There is the discarded draft of the Shadow over Innsmouth. There's some stories by, or there is story by John Glazeby, Richard A. Lupoff, Basil Cooper, Kim Newman, Paul McGauley, Hubie Cave, Steve Resnick Tem, Caitlin R. Kyman, Ramsey Campbell, ever hear of the guy? Michael Marshall Smith, Brian Lumley, ever hear of the guy? But yeah, that's Campbell and Lumley right there. That's definitely worth it. And I don't know. When it comes to murky, creepy, watery places, let's go with the British authors. They're just like always right by the coast. Yeah. Let's just go with that. Let's just go with that. That's a great theory right there. No. Anyway, but definitely check it out. Definitely check out Raised by the Moon by Ramsey Campbell. They're all good. They're all good. I love the illustrations in this. As all Finnegan and Bremmer books, it's bound really well, and I like the typesetting. You know, it's. I hate to be that kind of a book nerd who's like, I like the typesetting, but that's who I am, and I do. I really do. So if you get a chance, hop online, go to Finnegan and Bremmer's website, which I think is just finneganandbremmer.com. Let me double check that real quick. Definitely go to Finnegan and Bremmer. That is FEDOGANANDBREMER.com. That is FEDOGANANDBREMER.com. And they've got a lot of the books that I've covered in the past, whether it be The Madness of Dr. Caligari, or if it's something like Awaiting Strange Gods, or I don't know, many of the other just cool books by them that I've covered in the past. So check out this book, and yeah, you're going to like it.
The Discarded Draft of The Shadow Over Innsmouth by H.P. Lovecraft. It was the summer of 1927 that I suddenly cut short my sightseeing tour of New England and returned to Cleveland under a nervous strain. I had seldom mentioned the particulars of this trip, and hardly know why I do now, except that the recent newspaper cutting has somehow has wiped out most of the ancient houses along the deserted Innsmouth waterfront, as well as a certain number of buildings further inland, while a singularly simultaneous explosion, heard for many miles around, has destroyed to a vast depth the Great Black Reef, a mile and a half out of shore, where the sea bottom abruptly falls to form an incalculable abyss. For certain reasons, I take great satisfaction in these occurrences, even the first of which, to me, a blessing rather than a disaster. Especially I am glad that the old brick jewelry factory and the pillared order of Dagon Hall have gone along with the rest. The talk of incendiarism, and I suppose Father Iwanaki would tell me much if he chose, but what I know gives a very unusual angle of my opinion. I never heard of Innsmouth till the day I saw it for the first and last time. It does not seem to be mentioned in any modern map, and I was planning to go directly from Newburyport to Arkham, and thence to Gloucester. If I could find transportation, I had no car, but was traveling by motor coach, train, and trolley, always seeking the cheapest possible route. In Newburyport, they told me that the steam train was the thing to take to Arkham, and it was only at the ticket office when I demurred at the high fare that I heard about Innsmouth. The agent, whose speech shooed him to be no local man, seemed sympathetic towards my efforts at economy and made a suggestion that none of the other informants had offered. You could take that old bus, I suppose, he said with a certain hesitation, but it isn't thought much hereabouts. It goes through Innsmouth. You may have heard of it, and so the people don't like it. Run by an Innsmouth man, Joe Sargent, but he never gets any custom from here. Or from Arkham either, I guess. Wonder it keeps running at all. I suppose it's cheap enough, but I never see more than two or three in it. Nope, but those Innsmouth folks leaves at the square front of Hammond's Drugstore at 10 a.m. and 7 p.m. unless they've changed lately. Looks like a terrible rattle trap. I've never been on it. That was the first I had ever heard of Innsmouth. Any reference to a town not listed in the guide's book would have interested me. And the agent's odd manner of allusion roused something like a real curiosity. A town able to inspire such dislike in its neighbors, I thought, must be at least rather unusual and worthy of a sightseer's attention. If it came up before Arkham, I would stop off there, and so I asked the agent to tell me something about it. He was very deliberate, and he spoke with an air of feeling somewhat superior to what he said. Innsmouth, well, it's a queer kind of town. Down at the mouth of the Marquette. It used to be almost a city, quite a seaport before the War of 1812, but the place has gone to pieces in the last 100 years or so. There's no railroad. The B&M never went through there, and the branch line from Rowley was given up years ago. More enough houses than there are people, I guess, and no business to speak of. Everybody trades either here or in Arkham or in Ipswich. At one time, they had quite a number of mills there, but nothing left there but one jewelry refinery. That's a pretty prominent proposition, though. All the traveling salesmen seem to know all about it. Makes a special kind of fancy jewelry out of the secret alloy that no one else can analyze very well. They say it's platinum, silver, and gold, but these people sell it so cheap you can hardly believe it. Guess they have a corner on that kind of goods. Old Man Marsh, he owns the thing. Must be richer than Croesus. Queer old duck, though, and sticks pretty close around town. He's the grandson of Captain Obed Marsh, who founded the business. His mother was some kind of foreigner, they say, a South Sea native. So everybody raised Cain when he married an Ipswich girl 50 years ago. They always do that about the Innsmouth people. But his children and grandchildren look like nobody else so far as I can see. I've had them pointed out here and there, but never seen the old man. And why is everybody so down on Innsmouth? Well, you mustn't take too much stock in what people say around here. They're hard to get started, but once they do get started, they never stop. They've been telling things about Innsmouth, whispering about it mostly for the last 100 years, I guess. I gather they're more scared than anything else. Some of the stories would make you laugh, about old Captain Marsh driving bargains with devils and bringing imps out of the sea to live in the Innsmouth, and some kind of devil worship and awful sacrifices in some place near the wharves that people stumbled on to around 1850 or thereabouts. But I come from Plantland, Vermont. That kind of story doesn't go down with me. The real thing behind all this is simply racial prejudice. And I don't say I'm blaming all those that hold it. I hate those Innsmouth folk myself, and I wouldn't care to go into the town. I suppose, you know, though I can see you're a Westerner by the way that you talk. What a lot of our New England ships used to have to do with the queer ports in Asia, Africa, and the South Seas and everywhere else, and what kind of queer things, queer kinds of people that sometimes they brought back with them. You've probably heard about the Salem man who came back with a Chinese wife, and maybe you know that there's still a colony of Fiji Islanders somewhere around Cape Cod. Well, there must be something like that back of the Innsmouth people. The place was always badly cut off from the rest of the country by salt marshes and inlets. But we can't be sure about the ins and outs of the matter, but it's pretty plain that old Captain Marsh must have brought back some odd specimens when he had all three of his ships in commission back in the 1830s and 1840s. They certainly is a strange kind of streak in the Innsmouth folk today. I don't know how to express it, but it kind of makes your skin crawl. Notice it a little in Joe Sargent if you take that bus. Some of them have the flat noses and big mouths and weak retreating chins and a kind of funny rough gray skin. The sides of their necks are sort of shriveled and creased up, and they get bald very young. Nobody around here in Innsmouth will have anything to do with them, and they kind of act offish themselves when they come to town. They used to ride on the railroad, walking and taking the train to Rowley or Ipswich, but now they use that bus. Yeah, there's a hotel in Innsmouth called the Gilman House. I don't believe, but I don't believe it can amount to much. I don't advise you try it. Better stay out of there. Take the 10 o'clock bus tomorrow morning. Then you can get an evening bus out of there to Arkham at 8 o'clock. There was a factory inspector who stopped in at Gilman a couple years ago. He had a lot of unpleasant hints about the place, It seemed that there's a lot of queer folk around there, and this fellow heard voices in the other rooms that gave him the shivers. It was foreign talk, and he said it sounded like a bad thing about the kind of voice that sometimes spoke. It sounded so unnatural, slopping-like, he said, and he didn't dare go to sleep. He just got dressed and lit out of there early in the morning. The talk went on most of the night. This man, Casey, his name was, had a lot to say about the old Marsh factory, and what he said fitted in very well with some of the wild stories. The books were in no kind of shape, and the machinery looked old, almost abandoned, if it hadn't been run a great deal. The place still used water power from the lower falls of the Moquette. There was only a few employees, and they didn't seem to be doing much. It makes me think, when he told me, about the local rumors, and that Marsh really doesn't actually make the stuff he sells. Many people say he doesn't get enough factory supplies to really be running the place. He must be importing those queer ornaments from somewhere, heaven knows where. I don't believe that, though. The Marshes? They've been selling outlandish rings and armlets and tiaras and things for nearly 100 years, and if it were anywhere else where they'd got them, the general public would have found out about it by this time. Then, too, there's no shipping, no inbound trucking around Innsmouth. What would account for such rich imports? What does get imported is the queerest kind of glass and rubber trinkets. Makes you think of what they used to buy in the old days to trade with the savages. But it's a straight fact that all the inspectors run up against queer things at the plant. 20 years ago, one of them disappeared at Innsmouth, never heard of again. And I myself knew George Cole, who went insane down there one night. He had to be lugged away by 2 men over to Danvers Asylum, where he is now. He talks of some kind of sound and shrieks about scaly water devil. And that makes me think of all those other stories about the Black Reef off the coast. Devil's Reef, they call it. It's almost above the water, a good mark of the time, but you could hardly call it a real island. The story is that there's a whole region of devil seen sometimes up on the reef, sprawled out and darting in and out of caves near towards the top. It's a rugged, uneven thing, a good bit of a mile out. Sailors used to make great detours just to avoid it. One of the things they had against Captain Marsh was that he used to land on it sometimes when it was fairly dry. Probably the rock formation interested him. But there was talk about him having dealings with the demons, and that was before the big epidemic of 1846, when over half the people in Innsmouth were carried off. They never did quite figure out what the trouble was. It was probably some kind of foreign disease brought back from China or something by the shipping. Maybe the plague took out the best blood in Innsmouth. Anyway, they're a doubtful lot now. And there can't be more than 500 or 600 of them. The rich Marshes are as bad as any. I guess they're all what the people call white trash down in the south. Lawless and sly and full of secret doings. Lobster fishermen, mostly. Exporting by truck. Nobody can keep track of them, and the state school officials and census people have a devil of a time. That's why I wouldn't go down there at night if I was you. I'd never been down there, and I don't wish to go. But I guess a daytime trip wouldn't hurt ya. Even though the people here advise you not to take it. If you're sightseeing, Innsmouth ought to be quite a place for you. And so I spent the evening at Newburyport Public Library looking up data on Innsmouth. When I tried to question natives in the shops, the lunchroom, and the fire station, I found them even harder to get started than the ticket agent had predicted, and realized I could not spare the time to overcome their first instinctive retreance. They had kind of an obscure suspiciousness. At the YMCA, the clerk, merely discouraged by going into such a dismissal, decadent place, and the people in the library shewed much the same attitude, holding Innsmouth to be merely an exaggerated case of civic degeneration. The Essex County histories on the shelves had little less to say, except the town was founded in 1643, noted for shipbuilding before the Revolution, and set a great marine prosperity in the early 19th century, and later a minor factory center using the Moquette as power. References to decline were very few, though the significance of the later records was unmistakable. After the Civil War, all industrial centered in the Marsh Refining Company at the Lower Falls, and the marketing of its products formed the only remaining bit of major commerce. there's very few foreigners, mostly Poles and Portuguese, on the southern fringe of the town. Local finances were very bad, and but for the Marsh Factory, the place would have been bankrupt. I saw a good many booklets and catalogs and advertising calendars for the Marsh Refining Company in the business department of the library, and began to realize what a striking thing that the loan industry was. The jewels and ornaments it sold were the finest possible artistry and the most extreme originality, so delicately wrought indeed, that one could not but doubt that the handcraft played a large part in at least their final stages of manufacture. Some of the half-tone pictures of them interested me profoundly, for the strangeness and beauty of their designs seemed to my eye indicative and profound and exotic genius, a genius so spectacular and bizarre that one could not help but wondering whence the inspiration had come. It was easy to credit the boast of the booklet that the jewelry was a favorite of the persons of sophisticated taste, and several specimens were exhibited in museums of modern craftsmanship. Large pieces predominated, armlets and tiaras and elaborate pendants, but rings and lesser items were numerous, and raised or incised designs partially covering and partially with a curious marine motif were wrought in a style of tremendous distinctiveness and utter dissimilarity to the art traditions of any race or epoch I knew about. The otherworldly character was emphasized by the oddness of the precious alloy, whose general effect was suggested in several color plates, something that these pictured things satisfied me intensely, almost disproportionately, and I resolved to see as many original specimens as possible, both in Innsmouth and in the shops and museums elsewhere. Yet there was a distinct element in the repulsion mixed with the fascination, proceeding perhaps from the evil and silly old legends about the founder of the business which the ticket agent had told me.
Always listen to your ticket agent, people. This has been People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. I've been your host, D.B. Spitzer. And you can tell various audio qualities throughout this whole episode. This episode has been a pain in the ass to make. It's why it's taken so long to come out. Two computers, several courses of antibiotics, and several weeks of pain suffering due to ear infections, multiple ear infections of multiple parts of the ear. Same ear. Anyway, do you know that you can have an ear infection that lasts for over decades that just keeps coming back if it's deep enough in your ear? It's a fact. Anyhow, I'm recording this at 5:47 a.m., a couple of days before Thanksgiving, on Monday. I hope you all enjoy this episode, and if you do, go to pgttcm.com or pgttcm.podbean.com and donate some money. Let me know you like the show. And the more you donate, the better equipment I can get. And maybe, I don't know, afford to make better episodes. And if I get more money coming in, hell, I'll try and get guests and stuff like that. Talk to some people who know some stuff, instead of just me rambling to you. Alright, next episode will be a reading, and it will be written by someone who has the last name Gilman. And it will involve something with the color yellow and madness. Alright, the yellow wallpaper next time. Thank you for listening to People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. I have been your host, D.B. Spitzer. And remember, I don't have a catchphrase, so you should write one for me. Thanks. Bye. People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos is produced, edited, and all that other stuff by D.B. Spitzer. Music by Kevin MacLeod. It's awesome. Check out pgttcm.com. Check out the shirts in the shop. They're rad.
I gotta edit out some of this shit because it's stupid.